Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 22nd, 2004. Today's session number is CAD 2004-04. The speaker for today is Joyce Caldwell. The lesson for today is Summoning Out What We Shall Be, Parables of God's People, Longing for What is Lost. Let's listen in.
Or that may be cumulative, but I've tried to build each one as separate so that you won't be lost. Announcement on a resource in the bookstore that there are two books that I've recommended in there that I mentioned before. We Can't Teach What We Don't Know and Enter the River. And this set of Bible study and small group discussion guides called Regarding Bridges, Meeting, Building, Crossing. And it's a six-week session that you could take and use in your congregation. The parable of the workers in the vineyard and the rich man and Lazarus are in these books, along with discussion and a story from Acts 10 and 11. The other resource, if you're interested in some of these issues of race and what it means within the Christian churches, Lutheran perspective, but other Christian perspectives, is a new resource that I just finished writing in January that's being published by the ELCA, Augsburg Fortress, actually. We'll have it out early fall, and it's called Troubling the Waters for Healing the Church, A Journey for White Christians from Privilege to Partnership. And the parable that we're doing today and the story tomorrow are part of that resource. And that's actually an 18-session, year-long resource that follows the seasons of the church year, beginning with Advent and moving throughout the church year with different numbers of sessions during the different seasons and related to those in looking and understanding and unpacking what it means to be white within the church and within society and looking at a range of issues. Some of that's what we're going to get at today. So we're going to get started. I have to say that for the tape. My name is Joyce Caldwell, and the series this week is Summon Out What We Shall Be, part of the theme of Holden for the summer, and the Bible study theme is Parables of God's People, and we've been looking at different parables to help us look at who we are as God's people, and who we are as God's people in relationship with all of God's people, and trying to look at where are those places where we may leave some people out. You can come and fill in these chairs back. Yesterday, we looked at the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and within that parable really wrestled with those questions as we played out the rich man and Lazarus roles, and then looked at the chasm of separation in society. Wrestle with the question of who may we not see at times? Where are those places or times that there's someone that we don't really see as fully human or as fully a person, or who do we miss and sort of overlook? And within that, I laid out, because the rich man and Lazarus eventually come to the place after death that the chasm is put in place that's too great that can no longer be crossed. And the time element of that we have now to cross the chasms between people. And I laid out a wheel of oppression, the wheel of the making of an ism, of all of those, of racism, sexism, classism, heterosexism, ableism, that wheel that we get set up into where the times that we're on the inside of that by race, gender, orientation, age, etc., we sometimes fail to see the realities, lives, and experiences of those on the outside, or don't fully see. Today we're going to take a lens and look at what is the theme today is longing for what is lost. We're going to take a look at what does that mean to be on the inside, and what do those who are on the inside lose? And the particular lens we're going to look at, because, and this can, you know, crosses all of the oppressions, but it's easier sometimes to use one lens to understand it. We're going to look at the lens of whiteness, look at the lens of race, and ask the question, what is it that white people lose because of racism. We more often see in all of the oppressions what it does to people on the outside. Today we're going to look at what happens, what's that sense of loss, and what's in it for me in being able to really dig into these issues and understand them deeply. So we're going to look at two parables again today. And this is Luke 15. So we're back into Luke. Yesterday was Luke 16. Luke 15. And we're going to read the two parables, the parable of the lost sheep and the parable of the lost coin. So it's verses 1 through 7 and then verses 8 through 10. And we'll read each of the parables separately. So if someone would like to read Luke 15, 1 through 7.
Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. Of what man of you, having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost." Just so, I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance.
And someone else, 8 through 10.
Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents.
Okay. Parables of loss and finding, we're going to take a look at them again. And sometimes it's easy to read scripture and not really get the full feeling of it. Well, I'll tell you a story where I enter into this parable of loss. A number of years ago, when my older son was 3 years old, we were at Disney World, and we had just come out of It's a Small, Small World, and they line up all of the strollers outside. When we came out, we didn't know that they keep pushing them up, so we were kind of looking for our stroller and looking down, and Peter was right next to me, and my husband was looking for the stroller, and he finally said, "It's right here," and then he said, "Where's Peter?" And he wasn't there. He had been right there. And so we looked around, and he was nowhere to be seen. And we went to the guy who was there by outside there and said, "Well, my son was right here, and he's not." And he said, "Well, let's just walk around. You just go that direction." And he asked what he was wearing. And so we went and walked around and looked, and came back, and none of us could find him. And then he called some other folks to come and search a little wider area, and came back, nobody found him. And then he said, "You stay right here." He asked exactly what he was wearing, what he looked like, and they called all the security in the park. And I had all of these visions of they could take off his jacket, they could take off his cap. How would anyone know? I went into a huge panic on loss. And I have no idea how long it was. My sense of it was at least 30 minutes that we were standing there. It could have been a different amount of time. They finally came back and said, "We found him." And one of the security people, or one of the people who wanders, somehow managed to find him wandering around and picked him up. And he was heading over to see Dumbo. And we came there and found him, and I just broke down hysterically. And he said, "Why is Mommy crying?" And this huge sense of, you know, "Peter, anything you want in this park, you'll buy it." you know, sense of rejoicing. So we still have the big white bear. And you know, that it changed the whole flavor of that trip, of that sense of, you know, he's here, he's with us, and that sense of joy over finding him. So the parables have a lot to say around that. So I'd like you just in pairs, and just turn to somebody next to you and briefly share a story of loss or finding, or any place that, you know, this touches you, a time that you were lost, someone was lost, something was lost, and how you felt. Helpless?
Disbelief?
Guilt?
Okay.
Stupid.
Fear that the loss is permanent.
Okay. Yeah.
We said anger.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so many feelings that get caught up all there at once that it's hard to sort them all out. They're all present at that time. We're going to look today at that sense of loss, and this is kind of changing as another lens on these parables of who God is in there, and maybe, you know, what God means in this parable of searching for us when we're the ones who are lost. And as we were talking and sharing a little, that interestingly, we had a common lost child story, and both of our children still say that they weren't the ones lost. I mean, which is interesting, that those of us who are lost, that we think we're not really lost. It's everyone else who is. Which puts another twist into this story that we're going to look at in this, of the lens of whiteness in here, and who is it that's lost from the community? And who is God searching for? And so before we read those parables again with that kind of lens, I want to read a short couple of paragraphs from Wendell Berry in his book, The Hidden Wound. And you've heard the parable once, you'll hear it again after, but kind of think about that as Wendell Berry writes these words. I have been unwilling until now to open in myself what I have known all along to be a wound, a historical wound, prepared centuries ago to come alive in me at my birth like a hereditary disease, and to be augmented and deepened by my life. If I had thought it was only the black people who have suffered from the years of slavery and racism, then I could have dealt fully with the matter long ago. I could have filled myself with pity for them and would no doubt have enjoyed it a great deal and thought highly of myself. But I am sure it is not so simple as that. If white people have suffered less obviously from racism than black people, they have nevertheless suffered greatly. The cost has been greater, perhaps, than we can yet know. And he does use some male language in here, but I'll use his writing. If the white man has inflicted the wound of racism upon black men, The cost has been that he would receive the mirror image of that wound into himself. As the master or as a member of the dominant race, he has felt little compulsion to acknowledge it or speak of it. The more painful it has grown, the more deeply he has hidden it within himself. But the wound is there, and it is a profound disorder, as great a damage in his mind as it is in his society. This wound is in me, as complex and deep in my flesh as blood and nerves. I have borne it all my life with varying degrees of consciousness, but always carefully, always with the most delicate consideration for the pain I would feel if I were somehow forced to acknowledge it. But now I am increasingly aware of the opposite compulsion. I want to know as fully and exactly as I can what the wound is and how much I am suffering from it. And I want to be cured. I want to be free of the wound myself, and I do not want to pass it on to my children. So we're going to look at kind of that lens of what does it mean for white people to be caught in that wound of racism, and where is that wound reflected back on us in ways that we very seldom see and actually are very carefully taught not to see, or not to feel or not to experience. So we're going to look again with that kind of reading as a background and those stories that you shared of loss, to look again at these two parables and read it with that kind of a lens to see where are you in this story, who is it that God is talking about who is lost. And also again, put these two parables into context, that chapters 13 and 14 preceding this parable are a number of parables and teachings of Jesus where he is turning things upside down, where he's kind of changing that picture of who is part of the reign and the realm of God. And the chapter 16 following with the rich man and Lazarus, again, continues to kind of change that sense of keeps trying to tell the Pharisees and others that how they see it may not be the way that God sees it. And so kind of turning it upside down all the way in these parables before and after. So again, let's read verses 1 through 7 of chapter 15. And someone else like to read it this time so we hear another voice.
This is an interesting translation. I just picked it up because it's an American translation. All the tax collectors and sinners were coming to Jesus to hear him. But the Pharisees and the Bible scholars grumbled and said, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So he told them this story. "If any one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them, don't you leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the lost one until you find it? When you find it, you lay it on your shoulders and are glad. You go home and call your friends and neighbors together and say to them, 'Be happy with me, I have found my lost sheep.' So I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 good people who don't need to repent."
Okay. And verses 8 through 10.
I'll read it, Jim. Is it the next one? Is that okay? "Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, 'Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin.' In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents."
Okay. I'd like you now to get into groups of fours. So if there were a couple of you in twos before, you can join another pair. And in your group of four, some questions up here. And I'll give you about 10 minutes for these. So get through as many as you can. First, how did you experience and feel the sense of loss in these parables? And we've already done some sense of our stories of loss. But how did you experience it maybe again in the second time? Then, with whom or what have you normally identified in this text? You've probably heard this before. I think you're trying to remember, who do you normally identify with? And did you identify any differently in this reading, the second time through? Who do you see as being lost from the larger community? And at what consequence to the community when someone's lost? What would it mean to you if white people are the ones who are lost from the community? And in the parables and in life, what does it take for discovery and restoration to occur? So get through as far as you can. Some feedback from this. What was some of the conversation from one of your groups? Things you'd like to share with the larger group?
Who are the lost today?
Okay.
Some risk it for the 99 sheep that the shepherd leaves them.
Yeah.
And would you take the risk?
We talked about that. Or is there? I mean, I think that was an assumption that, well, you know, that's a pretty gutsy thing to do, to leave the 99 at risk. But is there a risk? Maybe they're perfectly safe, and it's just a feeling of abandonment. Mm-hmm. That the 99 are actually very well cared for. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they take care of each other. There's safety in numbers. I don't know.
It's an good shepherd. He's not a dumb flat.
We talked about the sense of all of us seem to have an understanding that God finds us and God searches for us, and how in some traditions that's not how it is. It's people's responsibility to find God.
Okay. Any other discussion?
We kind of brought up the thought process of being Mary of Christians and Mary of Christians who have all the answers, mm-hmm. and who's lost and who's not in that deal, you know.
We felt that the two stories, I think we learned this from each other, where at first we were supposed to think of them as just two different ways of telling the same story, we realized now that the second one, we were all more apt, especially Jan, to identify with the woman or with the experience of loss, because these were inanimate things, mm-hmm. coins, and the ones that were saved didn't seem jeopardized mm-hmm. by the search for the one that was lost. So we tended to identify in that one with the person who had lost something and with the experience of loss, whereas in the first one, the sheep being animate and vulnerable, we tended more to identify with the sheep that was lost. And so we saw the two as really inviting us into different identifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's much more intentionality kind of in that first, in the sheep, that the coins have no part really in being lost. Mm-hmm. So different identifications. Other thoughts and comments that came out of your groups?
Well, in identifying who are the lost, I was interested in the fact that I think in today's societies in Seattle, the homeless people out are the lost in our communities, and I think we are to be seekers to find them and care for them and today.
Okay.
I was thinking about the question regarding the white people, and if my world was to change where I was lost and to feel the vulnerability and such that other races might feel, it would be just a devastating change for my life. You know, because I'm just so used to things as they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you ever been lost in a foreign country? You feel lost.
Yeah.
Big time. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would like to know in the parable of the lost sheep, what is the role and the responsibility of the lost sheep to find itself or save itself? we know what the suggestion is that the shepherd would do. And we can speculate about what the rest of the flock might have done. But what is the responsibility of the lost sheep? How does the lost sheep go about finding itself? Does it stand there in a clearing and blow a whistle? Or, and the reason that's important to me is because when you get down farther in these questions, and you say, what if the lost sheep is white people, being a white people, that becomes an important question.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't know we're lost, just like our kids.
Mm-hmm. 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 You know, I have a question, though, because both of these stories, and I don't have an answer that goes with the question, so
that's,
you know, a lot of people, mm-hmm. but both these stories are about individuals and not groups that get lost. Mm-hmm. So how does that relate to our question about race?
And part of that is, you know, each of us individually, within that, do we recognize ourselves individually or as part of a group? And I think it relates back to your question of how do we know that we're lost, or do we know that we're lost, and then what's our responsibility? Or can we even know that we're lost? Sheep, from people who I know who raise sheep, say that they are the dumbest animals. That really when they're putting their heads down to graze, they just go off. Mm-hmm. And they don't have an awareness of what's around. Or an awareness of being able to find their way back, or an awareness of where they are. So they're a very interesting animal that Jesus uses in this. So
I was thinking another group that I know I think of as being lost from the larger community, and where they don't think that at all, is the people between the ages of 18 and 30. And you know, that's definitely one of these situations where we say, we as their parents or whoever look at them and say, oh my gosh, they're lost. And in the meanwhile, they're saying, but I'm off on this path of exploration. And in terms of the consequences to the community, my sense is that when a community receives those people back, when they do return to a worshiping community, often they bring new perspectives and sort of awaken the community and give it a broader sense. I mean, when you come here to Holden, this is our first time here at Holden, but the worship and you know that we've experienced has been very much enlivened by, you know, new perspectives, mm-hmm. things that we don't normally get in our own congregation. And so it seems to me that to some extent that, you know, having these members who either who were part of the group or even who we may never have felt were part of the group, when they come back or when they enter the group, that they enrich the group because of those excursions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll take one more comment.
We just came from the Double Mission event in Missoula, and one of the things, or several of the seminars that we were talking about is, to me, a loss of our perceived identity and role. And the loss of a role can be really important. And what they were talking about is that percentage-wise, Lutherans are definitely not very long the majority. And as a result, and looking at the way different people do different things, whether it's time, or whether it's the way you run a meeting, which we mentioned, or whether it's what you value, et cetera, et cetera, there's going to be decisions made that don't seem right to us. And we're going to lose our, quote, power. And that's going to be something that is going to be very difficult for those in or out of power. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We're going to look at that much more deeply tomorrow, too. So thank you for bringing that up. And it also leads into this next piece. And this is really going deep into some issues that usually I would take more time leading a group into if I had time, but we're going to go into that, into a deeper piece in looking at some of these issues that you raised about who are we as white people and what is that sense of awareness that we have in order to find ourselves
in this parable or to know where we are lost. So I want you again to get into a pair. It can be the same pair you were in before or another pair. But just pair up with one another. First, so you know who you were. Okay, in your pair. And I'm going to call time. I'll give you 1 minute. So before, decide who's going to speak first and who's going to be the listener. And I'll give you 1 minute. The person who is listening can only say to the person who is talking, if they get stuck, to repeat the question, and the question you'll be talking about is, when are you white? And so when you're the one speaking, just talk about your responses to that question. When are you white? And if you get stuck, silence is okay, but the listener can only repeat the question, when are you white, at those times of silence. And after 1 minute, we'll switch, and the other one of you gets to talk. So decide who's going first. Briefly reflect with your partner on what it was like to be asked that question. Just kind of reflect with your partner. What was it like to be asked that question? And what did you notice about yourself or each other as you were sharing?
Defensive.
Just share that with your partner for a minute.
Extremely uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I was really stuck because I've always been white.
I don't know anything
else about me. That's the way I feel inside.
Mm-hmm. I found that the having grown up totally in a white community, all of the discussions, the good feeling of all of a sudden coming into contact with some of the outer ring and the, I don't want to say liberation is what we use the word, but the plus it added to my own a life of having another contact, another perspective that I didn't understand, couldn't necessarily share, couldn't sit in their moccasins, but I felt that that was a growing point and that was a plus to me. And the more of those that I've had and had not, it's always been a little bit of a plus.
I think being white with SUVs, going out for really expensive dinner, taking the weekend in Las Vegas. But then also, on the other hand, I don't know the other cultures. So how do I know? I can't even identify with, I can identify with material things. We've been talking about that, haves and have nots. So, because I don't know their cultures. I probably eat different food, but I don't really know that.
So
we need to learn, that's what you're saying.
I think it was startling to hear my husband say that we're locked into whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
We're locked in. And so even if you meet somebody, I felt very white when I'm with somebody of color. And that I don't understand, and I know that there's a chasm, and I'm not even sure about bridging, whether that's something that is wanted by the other party. So I don't know, I just feel real insecure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you all hear that?
Mm-hmm.
And she did, that locked into whiteness and not knowing how to kind of bridge when you enter into relationship.
Well, you can't bridge when it's not in your world. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm fortunate. Mm-hmm. I do, my parakrok and I are like best friends, and it's taken us a while to get there, but we can talk about hard things, and it's just been a wonderful gift for me.
Who is this?
I work in the inner city, and my parapro, we work together, and she's black, and
okay.
So, but you have to put yourself in situations, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I have a brother-in-law who's black. And he's just a great guy. He's my favorite brother-in-law. We get along great. And I don't see that he's black. And I assume that that's a good thing. But that's not a good thing. That's diminishing him and turning him into who I am. Mm-hmm.
I don't feel particularly white. You know, I don't want to sound brighter, so I'm just saying there are ways, I think. Like, I didn't feel particularly white when if I speak in Spanish with people who speak Spanish, because that's really not a real white thing to do. Or also, when I was at a camp, and I had a girl next to me who was black, and when she welcomed me and helped me, and like she tied my hair, I was growing it out, so it was getting everywhere. She tied it back in kind of the black style. And that made some other people uncomfortable for a while, but only a little. So I didn't feel very white then either, and it was cool.
But you haven't built the walls. You're young.
Lots of comments.
Okay. Well, one thing I'm becoming more aware of is how rarely I'm white, really. How rarely I think of myself as white. I think of myself as a person, and I think that's a privilege that I have as a white person, that people of color don't have that luxury of just thinking of themselves as people rather than...
I had a career in civil rights for about 10 years, and I did housing investigations. Under the federal law, and there's several protected classes as well as race and color, but it's a very interesting perspective to be going out to seek out what are there differences in treatment and what are the differences in treatment, and at the same time to be aware of differences in treatment that didn't rise to a legal difference. And then there's also the perspective of is it the color that's making the difference? Is it another factor that's making a difference? Is it behavior? And people's perspective. For instance, I investigated one case where the couple violated all sorts of rules, and they even said, you know, it was just totally inconvenient to pay our rent, so we didn't, and I got evicted, and they were convinced they were evicted because they were a biracial couple. You know, and it was hard for them to see that the manager had really even given them a break by renting to them because they had a very poor rental history. But, you know, and I think they left, you know, even though the determination was written, they probably went on thinking, you know, that wasn't it. And it was a struggle to kind of try to always be discerning between, what are individual differences and when is it that color makes a difference?
I was thinking the same thing because I was thinking of a friend who was at Ohio State University, and he was in agriculture and plant path, and he was black. And they were trying to recruit more minorities into the university, especially into agriculture, because there weren't many. So they said, Michael, would you find us some poor black people? Michael said, I don't know any poor black people. He says, economy and education level is how basically our friends are chosen, even though we work to have our children meet black people, because a lot of the people, obviously, in this department were not black. And in his neighborhood where he lived, he says, nevertheless, he says, I don't know any black people who are poor. And we put all these people in one little bunch. And so it wasn't color that was making a difference there in his life.
Mm-hmm. It gets complicated.
Well, I'm almost just repeating this. Where we live in Tacoma, in the Parkland area, we have a military base close. We got every mix of marriages and people coming and going. And the biggest factors in that area tend to be more, I think, race is still a factor. I don't want to diminish it. But class differences and education differences will, in terms of who you feel kinship with, can often be even more prominent in that context. Although, again, I don't want to diminish the racial thing, because that's still a factor also. But the class differences and education differences are a major factor.
Are there any comments from up? Because I don't want to miss you.
I guess I don't know if I'm confused or concerned, but in that when we look at the community in terms of the parable, we all get to be lost. We all get to be found. I don't think God looks at us and says, this group is lost and this group is found, and but that a sense of that it's our position in the herd is not static. Sheep, the reason they get lost is because they're following their nose out of self-gratification and they're just looking for something good to eat. When they find it, they eat. They will eat till they make themselves sick. We all do that. And it's not because of anything but our human sinfulness. It doesn't have to do with our shape, our color, anything else. And I'm guessing, I can't see the whole room, there must not be any people of color in this room right now. Because I just wonder if I were a person of color right now, to equate that with being lost from the community, I would think would be hurtful. In terms of the parable.
Well, you're saying the opposite, though.
Right.
Yeah. You're saying it's the white feather flaws.
Well, that's sort of what I was thinking. We're sitting here assuming that if everything was equal between white and black, they'd want to move into our community. How do we know that?
No,
that's not what we're trying to figure out. We're saying they're lost and we're inviting them into our community.
No. I'm raising the question of turning the parable around as Jesus is turning all of these stories around. And it's...
So I may be confused, Joyce. I did say that at the beginning.
and that's the tough part, because we are sometimes found, we're sometimes lost. And in the invisibility of whiteness, what I'm trying to do is kind of turn this parable around as Jesus turns all of this, that often, as white people, and the way I grew up, really, in thinking that I was part of the 99. And kind of turning that around, that Jesus is challenging the Pharisees and the tax collector and all of those who may feel like we're part of the 99 and we are it. And everyone else would certainly want to be found, and that we're bringing other people into our community. If Jesus is turning this around, where are those times and places when we also have to consider the other part of the question of when am I lost? And looking at this, I'll wrap this up because our time is coming up. In looking at this from the perspective of whiteness, of thinking, when are we as white people the ones who are lost? That we're the ones who have wandered away from God's community, and wrestling with that piece of what does it mean to be white, and kind of wrestling with that for the rest of today as you go about your day, thinking about what does that mean? Because, as you said, most of us get up every day and don't have to look at the color of our skin and think about what's going to happen to me today, or how will my interactions be affected, or will I be followed around in the store, or where can I go, or where can't I go, where will I really be standing out, where will people be asking me to speak for my whole race, when will be people, looking at me because of the color of my skin. Robert Terry, in his book several years ago, wrote, "To be white in America is never having to think about it."
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And that's basically it. It's that piece of unconsciousness where we can go about life every day and then, as you said, assuming that everyone else should be like us. And imposing, as you said, our values on everybody else and expecting that everybody else functions the way we do. And not everybody else is. And it's kind of like being in that center of the circle, that people on the outside are looking at us on the inside and observing everything that we do. And when I've done this question, when are you white, also with people of color, they can also tick off like that when they jump into being white. Because people on the outside have to know how to function in both worlds. We don't. And that's, somebody said, the privilege and the loss for me as a white person of not being able sometimes as easily to jump into both worlds. And that's a process, and it's a gift to be able to understand when am I white and when is that getting in the way of my authentic relationships. That's when we start to move into understanding where is the loss for me as a white person. Where is that loss from community when I can't enter into authentic relationships because I'm afraid? Because I'm afraid I'm going to make mistakes? Because I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing? because I'm afraid that I may be called racist, because I'm afraid of not knowing how to respond, of not knowing exactly how to relate, and so we kind of walk gingerly around each other with people of color because we're not sure how. So it's a loss for me. It's also a loss within us as a collective community of white people that we also don't really trust each other at some very deep fundamental levels. We don't automatically walk into a room and see each other as brother and sister. We don't greet each other as, hey, sister.
Except at home.
Unless we've had a place where we have really formed community. We always kind of are a little bit wary of each other. Some sense of isolation, some sense of disconnect, some sense of competition, that within the white community, we highly have been programmed into a value system of individualism. And so we see each other as individuals, and that's one of the questions in the parable, that also that we see each other as individuals, many other communities see each other as community. So it's that piece of loss for us and that disconnect, the places where we wander away. Holden is different, but many white congregations, when we share the peace, peace. And then you walk into an African-American community, peace is
what's wrong with you?
There's a different sense and feeling, and so it's that piece of understanding who we are and really searching for, when am I aware, what does it mean to be white, where is that sense of loss for me in my journey, and where does that disconnect me from community?
We have to be careful because not all black people.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Just like not all white people.
Yes.
I think we have to be so careful to look at that individual. That's what racism is. That's what segregation is looking at a group.
Yes. It's kind of like, you know, a balloon that, you know, community, individual, and you can push on part of it and it bubbles up here and there. It's a both and continuum all the time.
And I think that's a very common thing,
Yeah, but it's, right, there's no either or.
Some people may say what makes one better than the other.
And it's not a better or. Again, it's what works. Our time is up, so you're free to go if anyone has questions. You can also stay and talk.